Lampstand Press presents Weft History Audio, original material written by Scott Somerville, edited and read aloud by Nate Somerville, with color commentary provided by me, Ted the Thread,
and special appearances by Christina Somerville as Nellie the Needle.
Year 2, Week 1, Twilight of the Western Roman Empire. If your family used Tapestry of Grace last year, you may remember that we wrapped up our study of the ancient world with the fall of Rome. There were barbarians at the gate, and civilization was in retreat all over Europe. That's where we pick up the thread of history this year.
Did I hear the word thread? Did somebody call my name? Hello. Is this microphone on? Can anyone hear me? Hi, I'm Ted the Thread, here to tell you about all the fun parts of history, and to help Mr. Nate here explain the words that you might not understand. I'm mostly always right about everything, so you can believe anything that I tell you.
You should not believe hardly a word he says. He's my cousin. He's nearly always wrong about everything. My name is Nellie the Needle, and I'm here to help Mr. Nate keep Ted in line.
Actually, Nellie and Ted, you're both kids, and you're both still learning. It's a good thing to ask questions when you don't understand something. I'll do my best to explain things for you as we go along. Kids, if you're listening at home, Ted is a thread, and he comes up with a lot of crazy ideas. You should not do anything that he says unless your parents say that it's okay.
Hey, why are you telling them that? I come up with great ideas all the time, like when I put peanut butter and jelly in my little brother's shoes yesterday.
Kids, if you're listening at home, you should never put peanut butter and jelly in anybody's shoes. You will get in trouble, and Ted will pretend like he never told you to do it.
Yeah, that's true. I will tell them that.
If you're going to put peanut butter and jelly in someone else's shoes, make sure you ask your mom or dad first, and then only put it into shoes that can be washed, like Crocs or sandals. You should never put peanut butter and jelly into sneakers or boots.
You know, I hate to admit it, but he does have a good point. Mommies already work hard enough without having to wash out sneakers or boots. You should only put peanut butter and jelly in Crocs or sandals, and then only with permission. It is funny, but we still have to follow the rules of our parents. If they say no, then you'll have to wait until you have your own kids, and then you can put peanut butter and jelly in their shoes. Ha ha!
Oh, I feel sorry for your kids already. We're going to talk about a lot of different countries this week, so you might want to have a good map of Europe handy so that you can find them all. This is the first week of Unit 1. And we're going to be learning about the Middle Ages. The Ancient Age, which you may have learned about last year, ended with the fall of the Roman Empire. And the start of the Modern Age began with the Protestant Reformation and the Renaissance. You'll learn about those in Unit 2 this year. The Middle Ages comes between those two, the Ancient and the Modern Ages. We date the Middle Ages from the division of the Roman Empire in 395 AD. To Martin Luther and the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in 1517. That's over 1,000 years of history. Constantine, the first Christian emperor, moved his capital from Rome to a city called Byzantium in what is now Turkey.
We just started school and it's already time for Turkey? Wow, the days are just flying past. Still, I do love Thanksgiving, but I didn't know that the Romans celebrated Thanksgiving. I thought that wasn't until the pillagers came to America.
Pillagers in America?
Yeah, you know those guys who wore funny black hats, like in Minecraft, and they hung out with Squanto, and they lived on a rock.
Oh, you mean the pilgrims. We'll learn about them later this year, and Turkey, in this case, refers to a country near Greece.
They named their country after a bird? Is the country next door named Chicken, and the country next to that named Ostrich?
No. Turkey is named after a tribe of fierce warriors who conquered those lands, the Turks. But that comes several hundred years after this part of our story. Right now, we're talking about Constantine moving from Rome.
Ah, okay. Go ahead then.
Constantine renamed Byzantium Constantinople, which means Constantine's city. Constantinople became the capital of the Eastern Empire when the Roman Empire split permanently in 395 AD. But Constantine did more than just build a new capital. He ended the official persecution of Christianity, and then made it the top religion of the empire. That made it safe to be a Christian, and you could even make money being a Christian. Before long, everybody who wanted to be important said that they believed in Jesus, even if they didn't really trust or obey him as their Lord.
So they pretended to be Christians? Well, why would they do that?
Leaders are important people, and they set the example for their people to follow. A good leader loves God and wants to obey him. When that happens, the people also want to obey and love God. But a bad leader will lead people away from God and teach them to disobey.
So if Constantine was a Christian, then was he a good leader?
He was better than the emperors before him. They tried to hurt Christians whenever they found them. But sadly, not everyone who says that they believe in Jesus really loves and obeys him. And we'll actually learn about that next. Under Constantine, the leaders of the church, who were called bishops, gathered in the city of Nicaea for the first great church council to decide how to answer an important question: who and what is Jesus exactly? There was some confusion and argument among the bishops about how to answer that question. A man named Arius, who was a popular teacher in Egypt, argued that the Son of God was not really God exactly, but was the first person that God created. Arius said, "If the Father begat the Son, he that was begotten had a beginning of existence. And from this, it is evident that there was a time when the Son was not. It therefore necessarily follows that he had his substance from nothing." And he also said that God has not always been Father. There was a moment when he was alone and was not yet Father. Later, he became so. The Son is not from eternity. He came from nothing. The problem is that it makes a big difference whether Jesus Christ is really God or only God's first creation. The church leaders decided that what Arius was teaching had to be stopped. So in 324 AD, the Council of Nicaea heard both sides of the argument and judged that Arius' teachings were heresy.
What is a heresy? Is that when I hear something from one person and then say it to another person? Like, when my friend tells me that his brother pretended to choke on his Cheerios at breakfast the other day, and then I go and tell Nellie the Needle, and she feels sick about it.
That would be hearsay. Heresy is a false teaching, a lie that pretends to be the truth. The Bible warns us that false teachers will come and try to teach Christians many kinds of lies, to lead them away from Jesus. Arius was one of those teachers. Although it seemed like he was saying something true, it was a sneaky kind of lie, one that meant that Jesus wasn't really who he said that he was.
But, Mr. Nate, how could that be so bad? I mean, sometimes people are wrong about who they think they are.
If Jesus wasn't who he said he was, then that means that he was a liar. If he was a liar, then that is sin. If he was a sinner, then he couldn't take our sins on himself at the cross. If he couldn't pay for our sins, then we are not saved.
Wow, I guess that is pretty important.
Yeah.
The question of who is Jesus is one of the most important questions you will ever answer. And heresies will try to give you the wrong answer. So we have to always watch out for those kinds of lies. So the Council of Nicaea said plainly that Jesus was fully God. And this is part of what we call the Trinity. It is one of the mysteries of Christianity.
What is a mystery? Is there a missing mummy? Did somebody take the last chocolate chip cookie? Should I call up the Paw Patrol?
A mystery is something that is true, but we don't understand it. When God tells us that something is true, he knows what he is saying because God knows everything. We should have faith and trust in his word.
So what is faith then, Mr. Nate?
Faith is when we believe God, even if we cannot see what we are looking for. Maybe you can see a tree outside your window during the day, but when it gets dark, you can't see that tree anymore. Is the tree still there?
Yes.
Yep. So, should I go get the chainsaw from the tool shed so we can cut it down?
No, no chainsaws. We are not going to cut the tree down. It's a perfectly good tree. The point is that even though you cannot see the tree right now in the dark, you can have faith that it is still there. You can believe in it even when you cannot see it.
Okay, so that's faith. Well, how does that help us with the mystery? Because the mystery is true, but you don't know, so you just have to trust it?
If we have faith, we believe in God, even when we don't know what he is doing or why he's doing it. If God tells us that something is true, even when we don't understand it, then that is a mystery. And our faith helps us to trust in God and to believe that the answer is out there somewhere. And it is a true answer. It's a real answer. But we just don't know what it is, at least not yet.
And the Trinity is that kind of mystery? One that we have to have faith in God for?
Yes. So, should I still call the Paw Patrol?
No, I don't think they're going to be able to help us with this mystery. The mystery of the Trinity is that we believe that there is one God, but that there are three persons. Each of those persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, is fully God. But there is only one God. There aren't three gods. And if that isn't easy for you to understand, don't worry. Many of the world's smartest grown-ups have had a lot of trouble trying to understand how this mystery can be true. The Nicene Council wrote something called the Nicene Creed, which defined for all Christians who God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit were. They wrote it down so that the Christians could learn what the truth was. Despite this, the idea that Jesus Christ was not truly God was still taught in both the Eastern and Western halves of the Roman Empire for hundreds of years. And many of the barbarian tribes who attacked Rome from the East believed the heretics, who were called Arians after their teacher Arius. But who were these barbarians?
Oh, wait! I know! Pick me!
Oh, I'm afraid to ask, but go ahead.
The barbarians were big, fat, bushy-faced, baby-eating, forest-dwelling swamp creatures. We're talking Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Swamp Thing, Yeti, and the abominable snowman. Sure, your cartoons want you to believe that these guys were basically lovable, just gentle, kind, and misunderstood monsters. But the truth is, you wouldn't want to meet any one of these guys in a dark alley anytime soon.
You know, in some ways, you're right, Ted. To the Romans, the barbarians were as scary as any Bigfoot that you might meet in a dark woods. But in the end, they were also just people. And most people in Europe are their great-great, many times great-grandchildren.
You mean you're descended from Bigfoot? This explains so much. The beard, and how your feet always smell like swamp mud.
Wow, thanks. While Rome lasted, the barbarians were the wild tribes beyond the borders. And many of them made their money by attacking the rich Roman provinces. Rome's soldiers tried to keep them away, but it got harder and harder each year. In Britain, which is another name for England, the Emperor Hadrian built a wall called Hadrian's Wall to help hold back the barbarian Picts and Scots, who lived north of the wall in Scotland. When the Roman government collapsed, there was nothing to hold the barbarians back anymore, and waves of invaders began to sweep through Europe. Many of these invaders were migrating west to escape from invaders of their own lands.
Migrating? Is that when you tell everyone how cool and amazing and terrific you are? My greatest talent is the fact that I could put peanut butter and jelly in the shoes of 14 kids in less than 3 minutes, and no one ever catches me doing it.
That's actually called boasting. Migrate is when a large group of people or animals moves from one area to another. For example, birds migrate south every winter and then back north in the spring. You've probably seen the geese as they fly overhead. When a large group of people moves from one country or territory to another, we call that a migration too.
Huh. Okay. By the way, I wouldn't put your shoes on for a while.
See, this is why I need a dog. to lick the peanut butter and jelly out of my shoes when Ted goes crazy. Anyways, so the invaders were migrating to the West to escape from invaders of their own. Those invaders were called the Huns. They were ferocious horsemen from the depths of Asia. They were attacking the settlements of the barbarian tribes of Eastern Europe. The Huns may have been from as far away as Mongolia originally. Attila the Hun was the fiercest of them all. He conquered and ruled lands from Russia to Holland and from the Black Sea to the Baltic. He fought against both halves of the old Roman Empire, Rome and Byzantium. He marched on Rome itself, but for some mysterious reason, decided not to attack it after a meeting with Pope Leo I, who came out from Rome to talk with him. The Hun invasions pushed a group of tribes called the Goths out of their homelands. The Goths were a Germanic people, and that means they spoke a kind of German language. And they have lived in most of Europe at one point or another. Archaeologists believe that they originated in Scandinavia. Then they moved south to Poland, and then they migrated down near the Black Sea, in what is now called Ukraine. When the Huns came, the Goths broke up into two main groups. The eastern group was called the Ostrogoths, and the western group was called the Visigoths. Both of these tribes began a mass migration to the west, and they ended up attacking Rome. The Visigoths migrated from the shores of the Black Sea down to Greece, and then up through the Balkans and down into Italy. Now, the Balkans are a lot of little countries north of Greece. They include Albania, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Croatia, Greece, Kosovo, Montenegro, Northern Macedonia, Romania, Serbia, and Slovenia. The Visigoths moved into the Roman Empire in 376 AD, and they reached Rome in 410 AD, about 35 years later. When they arrived, they sacked the city, throwing the civilized world into panic.
Sack the city? What does that even mean? I mean, I know a sack is like a bag, so does that mean that they had a giant sleepover? Thousands of barbarian bigfeets and yetis sleeping in the streets of Rome? The snoring must have been crazy.
Well, this time you're actually pretty close. It does come from the word sack, meaning a large bag, which is roughly the same in a lot of languages. English, German, Norwegian, French, Spanish, Italian, Latin, Greek, and even Hebrew, they all use a word that sounds like sack. In war, when soldiers conquered a city, their generals would sometimes let them take anything and everything that they could carry from the people who lived in that city. Other words like this are loot, plunder, and pillage. They all mean that the soldiers would take things from the people that they were fighting. If they win, they get to take it. And that was how the soldiers were paid.
But Mr. Nate, isn't that stealing? You're not supposed to take what doesn't belong to you.
It does seem like stealing, but it's different because they are at war. For example, God commanded the Israelites to plunder Egypt when they left during the Exodus. And he gave all of the lands and possessions of the Canaanites to them as plunder in the book of Joshua. God gives us the eighth commandment, you shall not steal. But he also commanded the Israelites to plunder their enemies. So we know that these two kinds of things, these two kinds of taking, have to be different somehow.
Ha ha! Oh, that's great! I'm going to go and sack Nellie's room and plunder her share of the cookie jar. Woo-hoo-hoo!
Stop, Ted. You are not at war with Nellie. If you take her things from her room or eat her cookies, then that is stealing. So you need to be careful not to confuse the two. So unless your parents are allowing you to play war and plunder, you should not be doing it.
Ah, rats. All right, fine. I guess I'd better fill up this pillowcase and put it away on the floor of my room behind the door where my mother will never find it.
The Visigoths didn't stop in Rome. They continued to migrate across the south of France and into Spain. By the time they finally came to a halt, they had lived in Sweden, Poland, Germany, Russia, Ukraine, Greece, most of the Balkan countries, Italy, France, and Spain. That's a long trip. After the Visigoths, the next barbarians to sack Rome were the Vandals. They were on the run from the Huns, too. They migrated across the middle of Europe to France and Spain, taking a more direct route than the Visigoths. And they went a great deal further than their fellow barbarians. They crossed the Straits of Gibraltar into northern Africa, and they conquered as far as Carthage, where they took to piracy. Rome was so busy dealing with Attila and the Huns that it couldn't do much about the pirates. But when Attila died, then Rome struck back. But so did the Vandals. They crossed the sea to Sicily and then to Italy, and they looted Rome in 455 AD. They were so destructive in looting and burning the city that to this day, when someone destroys someone else's property and causes a great deal of damage, we call that vandalism, after the Vandals. Rome wasn't built in a day, so they say, and it didn't fall in a day either. Even though the city was sacked more than once, Rome still continued to rule throughout most of the empire. In far-off Britain, for example, things continued as they had for centuries, except that Rome's legions were called home to defend the core provinces, and there were no new Roman soldiers to defend the borders. The end of Rome was a slow erosion in the distant provinces, not a sudden collapse. Sort of like when the tide washes away a sandcastle on the beach. It doesn't wipe it away all at once. Bit by bit, the castle crumbles until the whole thing finally collapses into a pile of sand, as if it was never there. Historians date the end of the Western Roman Empire to 476 AD, when a Germanic leader, Ottokar, kicked the last emperor off of the throne. That emperor was a teenage boy named Caesar Romulus Augustulus. You may remember that Romulus was the legendary founder of Rome, and Augustus was the first emperor of Rome. It is one of history's ironies that the last Roman ruler should be Romulus Augustulus, named after the founder and the first emperor of Rome. Romulus Augustulus was the last emperor because Ottokar did not claim the title of Caesar. He just called himself the King of Italy. Ottokar was clever. He knew that the Byzantine emperor, Zeno, would view him as a threat if he took the title of Caesar. His strategy worked for a while, but eventually Zeno sent Theodoric, the king of the Ostrogoths, to attack Ottokar. Ottokar surrendered 17 years after he took power, and he was executed on the Ides of March. That means on the 15th of March, in 493 AD. And this is another historical irony, because Julius Caesar, who paved the way for Caesar Augustus, the first emperor, died on March 15th. And Ottokar, the man who took over from the last Roman emperor, also died on March 15th. So the man before the first emperor and the man after the last emperor both died on the same day of the year. What do you suppose the Romans felt about the collapse of their thousand-year-old culture?
They probably had a parade and fireworks. They ate lots of hot dogs. Then they would drive big hay wagons full of screaming kids through the fields. And then the young men would wrestle pigs while the little boys would throw rotten apples at them. It was probably a great time.
Well, that sounds like the 4th of July or a country fair to me. Actually, the fall of Rome was a very scary time for the Romans. If Rome could fall, what other terrible things could happen?
Oh, I am so glad you asked. Godzilla could rise from the sea. Dragons could come and start eating their sheep. King Kong could tromp out of the jungle and start smashing their cities. Or a T-Rex could find our time machine and accidentally arrive in Paris and start eating French people. And then move down to Italy and start eating the Roman people.
Ted?
Yeah?
You did park the time machine back in the garage, right? And lock it?
Yes? Yeah, definitely. Yep. will you excuse me for a moment? I just have to go check on something real quick.
I hope this doesn't mean what I think it means. Anyways, the fall of Rome must have seemed like the end of the world to many of the Romans. And some pagan citizens blamed the collapse on Christianity. They thought that Christians were weak, and they feared that Christians had angered the gods who made Rome great.
Back in the good old days, when everybody worshipped Mars and Venus, we didn't have all these barbarian problems,
is the kind of thing that the grandfathers were saying. St. Augustine, the bishop of the North African city of Hippo, I know, that's a funny name, tried to answer these pagan critics. His book, City of God, explains how a just and good God could allow the barbarians to conquer the earthly city of Rome. Augustine argued that there were always two cities. One, the city of man, is what we see all around us. But there is also a city of God, made up of God's redeemed people, and that will stand even when Rome falls. Many Romans blamed Rome's fall on the Christians, and Augustine argued against that. He went back through Roman history and showed all the evil choices that led to Rome's collapse. Augustine argued that Rome's virtue had made her strong. During the great days of the Roman Republic, individual Romans showed character qualities like self-control, diligence, being careful with their money, and patriotism. After the Republic turned into the Empire, however, those virtues were harder and harder to find. In the Empire, the Romans were more interested in power, in pleasure, in greed, in piling up money, than they were in taking care of their homes or their homeland or their fellow citizens. They didn't love other people, they loved themselves. Rome's fall left many small kingdoms scattered across Western Europe. The Byzantine Empire in the east kept classical culture alive for centuries longer. But the areas that are now Italy, France, Spain, Germany, and Britain reverted to savagery. They were ruled by the barbarians. But in the darkness of Western Europe was the light of Christianity. The Roman Catholic Church cared for the souls of all the Christians who were living under the rule of different tribes and nations. And they sent missionaries to those pagan barbarian tribes. Many of those missionaries died trying to preach the gospel. They were martyrs. But they kept going until those barbarians also became Christians. The Roman Catholic Church and its leader, the Pope, became the cultural force that united the savage warlords of Western Europe.